Hi, welcome to Off Script. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Today on the show, what might be one of the best double features we have all year? I can't believe it. I knew I might like 20 Years Later, The Bone Temple. I figured I was going to like No Other Choice. Both of these movies are fantastic. I'm so excited to talk about this banger double feature on Off Script today. So thank you for joining us. We're talking about 20 Years Later, The Bone Temple, a new film from Nia DaCosta, follow up to 20 Years Later, the Danny Boyle film just 7 months ago from Sony. We're talking about No Other Choice, new Park Chan-wook film. Very excited to talk about this movie. This follows a decision to leave from just a few years ago. We're talking a little bit about Fallout, the show on Amazon Prime. Season 2's out. Andy's been watching it. Also, Night of the Seven Kingdoms on HBO, that Game of Thrones follow-up. We know a little bit about that, too. First, before we get to everything news, quick hits this week. Gonna be honest, not a big news week, and I think that's okay. First story from Variety. Netflix is offering Warner Brothers all cash for their big company. It's like $83 billion. This is a change from what they were doing before. Not a big announcement, but really that what that is to say is that Warner Brothers is voting on Netflix buying them in April. So all that news you've been hearing about Paramount offering a cash deal and billionaire David Ellison trying to wrangle a new way and maybe they're going to sue them and Netflix is switching to all. They're going to keep doing that till April. April is when we're going to know what the move is. That's the news. That's the news story I got for you. There's a whole lot of stuff up in the air, but I just if you're sick of hearing it, April. That's when we're supposed to hear. Do you have anything to offer this, Andy? And normally I just throw to you on these, but like it's just a lot of mumbo jumbo and big capitalism numbers. You know what I mean? I can't keep up with it.
Yeah, it's a lot of investment banking, mergers and acquisitions talk. I don't really understand most of it. But the main thing to take away is that these things take time. Like,
yeah.
A merger doesn't happen overnight. This will be years before Netflix completely owns and then actually, like, it's probably going to be 3 to 4 years before we see a proper, assuming Netflix gets this, ends up buying them successfully, it will probably be another 2 years to actually get it approved, get like federal approval, and then another, 1 to 2 years to actually get something out of the gate. These things take time. When Disney bought Fox Searchlight in 2019, we didn't see anything for about 4 or 5 years. It takes forever. And I don't think we've seen a whole lot of completely original things as much as like, we've seen the X-Men now in the MCU and the Marvel properties, but we haven't seen like a standalone X-Men movies, things like that. So these things take time.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Paramount is getting a lot off the ground in terms of creative properties. Their television stuff's going great, right? They wrapped up Yellowstone with Taylor Sheridan. They're doing Landman, I know, which is a big hit. Big. I keep saying they kind of have a big conservative lean over there, and they definitely do. Like, not only does the Trump administration seem to be a big fan, but Paramount is owned by billionaire Larry Ellison and his son David Ellison, who really seems to be the guy running the Paramount show to get them to get Warner Brothers, and he's the one who's like, we're switching to all cash and we have some sweet deal and we're bringing Saudi Arabia in to try to buy the historic Warner Brothers film studio and none of it's working because Warner Brothers seems to just want to go to Netflix. So yeah, now there's some talk of like that maybe they're gonna sue, which is like so lame, dude. So I don't know. We don't know anything about that. All right. That's all up in the air. No slander here on Off Script. But what we do know is, yeah, the Warner Brothers board is voting in April. So it's going to kind of hopefully be a little chill till then. If David Ellison is taking any inspiration from his heroes, he's probably going to pull this into court and pull some junk. But I don't know, dude. I don't know. Anyway, off of this, on to the next thing, Star Wars. Big shakeup at Star Wars. You might have seen this earlier in the week. Star Wars head Kathleen Kennedy is stepping down. You're not going to believe who's stepping up to take care of things over Lucasfilm. Andy, what do you know?
You probably are going to believe it if you follow Star yeah, Wars or Lucasfilm.
Yeah.
But George Lucas' protege, Dave Filoni, is going to be stepping into the big shoes as head of Lucasfilm, along with executive Lynwen Brennan, who will handle the business side. Filoni's been with Lucasfilm for like 20 years, 25 years. He first came up during the Clone Wars, the animated series in the double aughts, and has kind of shepherded some of the TV side of things. And I mean, Kathleen Kennedy has a storied career. I mean, she was huge when she came into the chair. She of course executive produced things like E.T., like Indiana Jones, like Jurassic Park. So like big hits under her belt, and then she came on to be ex- be head of Lucasfilm in 2012 whenever Disney bought them. Some ups and downs in the Kennedy administration where she brought on the kind of the modern era of Star Wars with The Force Awakens, which was a huge $2 billion film, highest grossing domestic film of all time. And then they started kind of taking some chances. Last Jedi ended up being very controversial. Rise of Skywalker, very bad. But all those movies made money. And then they kind of stepped back and they really leaned into the TV properties with the advent of Disney Plus, with things like The Mandalorian and Grogu, The Mandalorian show, which was a big hit initially, and then some other properties that weren't. So it's been a real roller coaster of ride for Kathleen Kennedy over the last 15 years.
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk, I think, over whether or not she should kind of be ousted as the head of Star Wars based on kind of where they're at now. I would think Andy and I are probably of similar mind that, yeah, I think it's time for a change at Star Wars for sure. But also, yeah, it's hard for me to say that Kathleen Kennedy is the sole reason this stuff has happened. Like, she is one of a large team of people. And yeah, her record kind of speaks for itself. One of my favorite recent memories probably long time memories of Kathleen Kennedy, if I have any, was going to see Raiders. Andy and I went and saw Raiders, like, in concert, symphony orchestra, a year ago now, with a good friend of ours. And, like, sure enough, in the opening credits of Raiders, they're, like, playing all that stuff, and you're in the jungle, and it's popping up with, like, Steven Spielberg film, Raiders of the Lost Ark, starring blah, blah, blah. And then it gets to, like, produced by Kathleen Kennedy. And it's like, good God, there's her name all these years ago, putting in the work on, like, blockbuster historic features. So there's a reason Star Wars is where it's at. I'm not pinning everything on Kennedy. I do think it's time for a change. Let's look forward. As for Dave Filoni, I don't know, man. I feel like when I was younger, I thought Dave Filoni was the guy. Like, he had really lit a fire under the property with Star Wars The Clone Wars. That was kind of his big baby project that turned into, like, multiple television series, movies. Like, they reignited a fire with that, for sure. Like, that has been rolled into a lot of where we're at now. But also, like, there's some word that he's, like, not a fan of Andor, which, like, people seem to historically really like. People seem to really like Andor. I don't know where he lands on Mandalorian and Grogu, but I know there's a movie coming out for that. Like, I don't know where Star Wars is headed, but I'm going to be honest. If it's heading in back into Clone Wars, because that's where Dave Filoni wants it to go, I'm not confident that is a good direction. I don't think Star Wars should be going backwards. I think Star Wars should be boldly going forward. No Star Trek pun intended.
So Kathleen Kennedy will still oversee the last two movies that they greenlit, which will be The Mandalorian and Grogu, which comes out this summer in May, and Star Wars Starfighter, which is May 2027 next year. So she'll still shepherd those two final projects in, and then the Filoni stuff will kick in. And word on the street is they're looking to kick in or ramp up production on stuff. Star Wars kind of been spinning its wheels for the last several years, and again, really focused on the TV properties. So it looks like we might start getting more more films. But yeah, Dave Filoni, he's all about the older school stuff, kind of the extended universe, isn't looking to move forward. It's like Star Wars ends with Episode 6, Return of the Jedi, and everything else just kind of fits neatly into that, or not so neatly into that timeline. So it'll be interesting to see what we get. At the same time, Star Wars just is this huge institution of a property. It feels like you can't do too much new because, you know, there's fans who they only want it to be like it was when they were 12, and then there's fans who want to see new things. I would love to see new things, new stories. I would love to see a Jedi again. I love they have all these Star Wars properties. No one's a Jedi anymore. I hate it.
I know. And like, notably, Disney is a sequel company now. And, like, that's part of what's frightening about this, right? Like, they're making so much money on just reheat what worked before and reserve it, right? Either do a live action adaptation or do a sequel. That's just kind of where they're at. And that has me a little concerned about where we're headed, because it seems a whole lot like it's going to be like, just keep reheating what worked, right? Trot it back out. It'll be great. We'll see what happens over at Disney and at Star Wars. One more story to talk about, just a quick one from the box office. 20 years later, The Bone Temple, not quite doing, I think, as well as people had hoped. It's particular circumstances, and there's still a third film coming. Sony confirmed this last month, but a bit of an underperformance, huh?
Yeah, so it came in at $13 million for the 3-day weekend. They were hoping for between 15 and 20. So a little underperformance, but it's, you know, January is always a tough month, and it's, you know, it's a hard R horror movie. You're not taking the kids to this. Avatar Fire and Ash came in at 14.5 million. That's what won the weekend and is now across the 1.3 billion mark. Obviously a huge flop for, no, of course not. It continues to do well internationally. Other stories, Utopia 2 hit 1.7 billion. It's now the highest grossing animated feature of all time. One of the highest grossing movies for Disney, the ninth highest grossing movie of just all time. Crazy numbers. The Housemaid continues to do really well. 8.6 million over the weekend, 245 million globally. So it's an international hit. That's huge. And that was a relatively modest movie. I think it had like a $30-40 million budget. So it's doing really great. And Marty Supreme is very close to hitting the 100 million dollar mark, which would be the highest grossing film for A24. It was also very expensive. So they're not making any money on that film, but it's more about like, it's an Oscar thing. It's for the art. That sort of thing.
Yeah. And you know, that's not a bad reason to make a movie. We watch plenty of movies like that on the podcast. I was reading something about Avatar 3 fans trying to like rally and get people to go to like extra screenings just to try to bump the numbers up. I think Avatar is in a funny place. I think we're supposed to get Avatar 4 and 5 for sure, but like last week there was an article from Cameron saying like, you know, we got to figure out a way to make these Avatar 4 and 5 cheaper because they're really expensive and they take a lot of time and they need to be faster. He's talked about wanting to do this live action film, Ghost of Hiroshima. He's talked about maybe wanting to step away from it. Avatar 3 is the lowest earner of the series. Don't get me wrong, 1.3 billion is an awful lot of money, but it does seem like the guy driving the engine at the top of the car is saying, hey, this is going to have to run better for future iterations to work. Like, things need to change a little bit. You know what I mean? So, don't know what that means for the franchise. Obviously, Avatar 3 will make its money. As for the rest of the box office, I don't know. I think I'm good to talk about 28 years later. You good, Andy? Anything else you want to weigh in here?
Yeah, other than, again, the family stuff seems to be doing really well. Zootopia 2, huge international audience. Who knew? People love Zootopia 2. Crazy Animal City, as it's known in China.
Is it really Crazy Animal City?
Yes.
That's a good name. I like that. All right, man. Well, let's jump into it. I'm going to be taking the summary on this, so please excuse me, funny delivery. The movie is 28 years later, The Bone Temple. So, 28 years later, The Bone Temple is the immediate follow-up to last year's 28 Years Later, which was directed by Danny Boyle, script by Alex Garland. Bone Temple is also script by Alex Garland, but with new series director Nia DaCosta, who formerly did, oh gosh, The Marvels and Candyman, and she just did a movie called Hedda with Tessa Thompson that came out late last year. This is very different than all of those. This is actually quite different from the previous entry, 28 Years Later. We pick up the film right where we left off in the previous entry with Spike, played by Alfie Williams, who has been abducted by the Fingers Gang, led by Sir Lord Jimmy Crystal, played by a very sinister Jack O'Connell. The Jimmies all wear these funny wigs, and they all wear funny tracksuits, and all talk funny, and follow their Lord Jimmy Crystal anywhere he goes as they wander the countryside, killing zombies, and more importantly, kind of finding survivors and having fun with them in their own twisted fashion. The movie opens a quite violent scene where Spike has to quickly fight to the death another Jimmy. And shortly after that, he's abducted into the group and we're on our way. We also get a good look at a returning character, Dr. Kelson, played by Ray Fiennes, who is running his little bone temple. He calls it the ossuary out in the wilds. And he is developing a sort of a funny, I guess I'd say, relationship with this alpha zombie out there that he calls Samson's very large man, brooding hulk of a man played by Chai Lewis Perry, who's in the previous film as well. Often nude. Lots of nudity in 28 years later at the Bone Temple, and lots of gore too. Good God, we'll talk about the gore a little bit. These two storylines kind of intertwine. As Dr. Kelson begins to learn a little bit more about Samson and find that there may actually be a way to start to maybe reverse the symptoms of the rage virus and maybe find a little bit of humanity in these kind of walking zombies, Spike is pulled deeper and deeper into the world of Sir Jimmy Crystal, and he's just seemingly unable to get out of it until eventually these two forces come to a head in the film, and that's where things start to get particularly wild. There is a third film to follow this. Sony announced last month that they're going to go ahead and shoot it, although this one is underperforming a little bit at the box office. We have that to look forward to. Not sure when that's coming, but that's 28 years later, The Bone Temple. Andy, what'd you think of this movie?
Man, so I really, really enjoyed it. Very different kind of movie. Darker in a lot of ways. Like, it's more like a horror movie where, like, the first movie is a coming-of-age movie. This one leans much more into the horror. There's a lot of gore. I had walkouts after the opening scene, which is pretty brutal. Four people got up and walked out after the opening 10-minute scene, which I was like, oh, yeah, we're in for it. But it's also about very different things. Again, the first movie, as Danny Boyle has said, is about the nature of family. The second movie, he said, was going to be about the nature of evil. The third one will be about the nature of redemption. But in this one, yeah, it is about evil. And we meet Sir Jimmy Crystal, who is the most evil. He is kind of this idea of unchecked power. He's someone who is taking advantage of this situation, of the infected, of this lawless land, where him and his gang just kind of rove and kill people for their resources and in torturous fun. And he's really brainwashed the fingers that he is kind of in contact with spirits from the beyond. And that's why he's in charge. He's in charge because he's, you know, a conduit of these things. And he also, like, keeps them fed, but is providing resources but also makes them do very violent things. And our protagonist from the first film, poor Spike, is dragged into this world that he doesn't want to be in and doesn't really fit in. And he kind of takes a little bit of a back seat. This is less about him and more about, it is more about Dr. Kelson and Sir Lord Jimmy Crystal. It's a very different film, very brutal, like way more brutal than the first movie in a lot of ways. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah. I so much enjoy the script from this, and Garland is really doing something different in these films. Like, whereas the original 28 Days Later that he helped write was much more like a traditional zombie feature with some kind of lofty themes in there of, like, isolation and desire for community. Like, these three, this new trio, like, are very much more focused on people and themes and belief and faith and community. And it's particularly this one, like, masculinity and kind of our relationships to one another. But so much of that, I think, gets buried by, or not buried, but I think, like, I don't know, I think a lot of average audiences are maybe going, thinking it's going to be a bit more gory or a bit like that original one. And I've seen people say that, like, well, this one, you know, like, the zombies are weak. Like, they're hanging out in the back. And it's like, it's not really about the zombies anymore. The zombies are 28 years old. You know what I mean? They've been rotting out in the woods. Like, they're kind of, the zombies are nerfed a little bit. You know what I mean? That's where we're at. Like, roaming gangs have been killing these things. Kelson has been collecting bones for like 30 years. You know what I mean? So that's not really where we're at. And that's part of the reason that Ralph Fiennes really likes these projects. And he's so tremendous in them. Like he takes such odd roles. The big obvious villain role you could point at him is something like Voldemort, right? But like doing something like this is so different and strange. And Kelson in this one in particular is very physical. There's a lot of dancing. He's got a record collection, and he can spin some tracks. And so there's a lot of singing and dancing in here, leading up to like kind of a large performance on the third act of the film from him. And like it's a lot of like body writhing and swinging. There's plenty of nudity as well, not only from him but also from Chai Lewis Perry, who is a zombie who's running around nude. Lots of dick. They just got it right out. I think I can say that on the pod. I'm sure it's fine. We're all adults here. Yeah, they just got it right out, and it's just that's just how it be. You know what I mean? And like, I think that he sees that. I think the people all playing this see that. They see that this is not just a gore fest. That being said, all that out of the way. Oh my God, this is the goriest of all of these movies. Stomach churning gore, eye popping gore, stuff that like I was like leaning in my seat way back, like, oh my God, like I can't believe how brutally gory this is. And not just like gore towards adults, towards children, kids dying and like begging for their lives is like as they're bleeding out and stuff, like brutal, brutal stuff. Charity. In this movie. We're talking like Eli Roth's Hostel, Saw 1 and 2 kind of brutal, like terrifier levels of gore in this movie, which is such a weird like underline for all of these really lofty spiritual themes.
Yeah, it's Jimmy Crystal calls it a charity. Like, will we give them charity?
Yeah.
Meaning the worst thing you can ever think of. Yeah, this movie, it's really different. Like I said, thematically, one of the things I got out of it was this idea of power and kind of where it comes from. And we see Dr. Kelsen, his power comes from knowledge, but also compassion and kindness. Samson is obviously strength. Like, he's the strongest of these alpha infected, not zombies. And then Sir Jimmy Crystal, his power kind of comes from deception and lies. And essentially, he's created a religion, and he has deceived his followers through that. You know, I think there's a little bit of that, like, religion versus non-religion idea in the movie, but it's about the abuse of that. And one of the things that's interesting is Jimmy Crystal starts to, his grip on power and his gang starts to slip a little. You know, they start to wise up a little bit to his act, but they're also terrified of him, so they're a little bit too afraid to move. So they're looking for an opportunity as well. And then we get some incredible set pieces. There's a number of harrowing chases. There's a big barn scene that everyone's talking about. There's a big scene in the Bone Temple again that you might have seen some. So we get plenty of action along the way too.
Yeah. One of the things I thought was interesting is the editing in this one. It is so much slower paced than the editing of 28 Years Later. I watched a bit of 28. I was traveling this weekend. I watched a bit of 28 Years Later on the plane on my phone. I didn't watch the whole thing because I just wasn't. I don't think it's an enjoyable experience to watch on a phone on a plane. Like, this one's much more fun with a big screen and a loudspeaker. But just in the first like 20 minutes of 28 Years Later, like it's cut with a razor blade, man. Like, it's like fast digital cuts, very quick stuff. Very echoes a lot of what he was doing in 28 Days Later years ago. This, with new director Nia DaCosta, is way slower, way more paced. You get like time lapses, way more tripod, like stuff that is way more locked down and thoughtful, push-ins, pull-outs, and much more paced editing, I should say, as well. I hate to say slower because I think it moves just fine, but it is a bit slower in that way. And I went and looked. The previous editor of the last movie was a guy named John Harris, who did a great job, but tends to cut really fast. This new editor's a man named Jake Roberts, and I thought was notably interesting. He is Alex Garland's most frequent recent editor. He edited Civil War. He edited Men. He also did Alien Romulus for Fede Alvarez. And I think, based on Garland's interactions here, the fact that he's editing for Nia DaCosta makes me wonder if at some point Garland was maybe in the running to direct this one and then just kind of decided not to. He got weird with Warfare, and like, he kind of co-directed that with Ray Mendoza, who'd never directed a movie before. But like, you watch Warfare and you're like, this is an Alex Garland movie. Like, it just feels very obvious. Garland also historically has history of kind of ducking editing on movies. He reportedly directed Hellboy. That, you meant the original Hellboy, but like, he kind of backed off on that because he didn't want to be responsible for that. Like, I don't know. He's funny with directing, and he says he's not going to do it anymore. But like, for what's here, it's like, the DNA of his work, I feel like, runs more deeply in this than maybe it does in the first, because Danny Boyle was just like cutting it up hard on 28 Years. This is slower and a lot more thoughtful.
Yeah, again, it's thematically so different. That first film, a lot is about the kind of the island of people kind of living in stagnation, which is it's essentially about a stagnant UK, a stagnant Britain. We don't get those same themes in here. Like I said, it's concerned with different things. It's a much smaller movie. You can tell it probably didn't have the budget of the first one. Like I said, our cast of characters is much smaller. We have the Jimmys. We have Dr. Kelsen. We have a couple of other players, but it's smaller in scope. Like I said, Spike takes a back seat for most of it. It's less about him, which I'm interested to see how that will all kind of turn around in the third film, which is probably going to be a couple of years away. Like, they shot these two back to back. That's why we got them so quickly. But I mean, they're not even entered production to this yet.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I thought there would be a little bit more that comes in from the last movie. There's no Aaron Taylor-Johnson, though there is a guy who looks a lot like him in an opening scene.
I've seen a lot
of people online that were like, I thought that might be him. And I swear it had to have been intentional for him not being in this movie. That guy's costume design was way too close to Aaron Taylor Johnson. There's no Jodie Comer.
We have ATJ at home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's no Jodie Comer. But there is a mom character who, like, very briefly appears. She's kind of a Jimmy victim. And she kind of has a funny one-off with Spike briefly, and I think there's maybe a bit of a relationship there. I think the movie has a lot to say about masculinity, like not only with like Kelson and Samson hanging out and like getting naked together, which is its own thing, but like the way the Jimmys interact with one another and all wear wigs and act like they're particularly male, even though a couple of them aren't. There's very few female characters in the movie. You got Erin Kellyman, who's really tremendous. She's really great as Jimmy Inc, I think is her name. You've got another one of the Jimmys, who's a gal, and then like that mom character I mentioned, and I think that's it. Maybe some female infected running around, but like that, otherwise it's all dudes. You have your young Alfie, his father's not around. Kelson is kind of a father figure for him. Jimmy at one point has a conversation with Kelson that it like echoes thoughts of his father, who's mentioned in the first film. Like, just a lot to unpack and kind of simmer in. And like, if you're dedicated to it, if you've gotten through these first four films, like there's something really rewarding going on in Bone Temple. If you're coming in fresh, I don't know, you probably need to go see the first one. I feel like you get watch this and be like, I just feel like I stepped into the middle of a story, and that's by design. But great work from DaCosta. Really great. I liked her Candyman movie, man. Like, and I like this. I'd struggle with Marvels, but I think she knew everyone's gonna struggle with Marvels. Like, and I haven't seen Hedda, but like she's doing really great work.
Yeah, I don't really have too much more to say other than it was nice to get a little bit. Again, it's not the same film, it's not the same director, it has a different feel, but it's like I said, it's darker, it's more brutal, it's also smaller. Great performances all around. Ralph Fiennes getting to do really fun stuff in his late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah. Andy, would you recommend 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple? I just realized I didn't change the band at the top of the thing. Let me take that again. Andy, would you recommend 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple?
Absolutely. Again, a great follow-up. I'm struggling now, too. A big follow-up to the first film, 28 Years Later. It's brutal. Don't Take the Kids. It's a hard horror film. I had people walk out. But it's... like all good horror, it's talking about deep things. You know, we have our father son relationships. We have this idea of power and religion and versus science and incredible set pieces, accents. I mean, there were parts like my body left my chair a couple times in some of these great sequences. So highly recommend.
Yeah, I think this movie rocks. Would recommend. It's a ton of fun. Check out 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple. Dude, bring a barf bag. Good God, I couldn't believe some of the stuff they're doing in this movie. Like, hold on to your hats, kids. It's hard. Goes hard. It's a good movie. Would recommend. With that, we should jump into a little bit of television, all right? And a special segment that we like to call... Go for it.
Welcome to the TV Corner.
Yeah!
We're going to be catching up on a couple of things. Fallout Season 2 just finished Episode 5 last week. I'm struggling a little bit with this show, mostly because there is simultaneously too much and not enough going on. And what I mean by that is that it's very slow, and there's like 6 or 7 storylines that are all very disparate. They're starting now in Episode 5 to sort of come together, and there's some good sequences, but man, there's just too much going on. So our main characters, Lucy McClain and the Ghoul, they're on their way to New Vegas. That's one storyline. We have flashback storylines, multiple flashback storylines. We have people in the, we have two vault stories. We have a group that's outside the vault. We have a group that's still in the vault. We have Maximus and the Brotherhood of Steel and what's going on with them and some other factions. And because there's so many storylines, we don't really get a lot of screen time with everyone, especially our stars, Walton Goggins and Ella Purnell, who they're kind of not in a lot of the earlier episodes. I was like, when are we going to get back to that? It has to jump around so much. It's starting to coalesce a little bit more, but man, I'm really struggling with it. And it's also just slow. It's turning into a show that I'm watching with my phone out and just kind of looking up every now and then.
I think Amazon has such a funny problem with the show. Full disclosure, I watched the first season. I have not started Fallout Season 2. I just haven't seen a lot of marketing for it, which is weird because I'm kind of like right in the zone where I should be to watch this show. I'm kind of the perfect age group and played the games and watched the first one, but for some reason just has not made its way to my corner of the internet. That being said, and I'm hearing from my friends that are watching it that like, it's kind of boring. the main characters are hardly in it. And it's a bummer because, like, that was a problem with season one. It was like, you have your one really interesting A plot line with Lucy, Fallout, and the ghoul. You got, you know, your B with Maximus, which is okay. I could use less of that, actually, but I guess it worked. The flashback stuff with Walton Goggins is fine at the beginning. I like that. Okay. Anything that happened in the vault, cut it. Sucks. Bad. And it turns out, like, for season two, they were like, we're going to put in more slop. That's what we're going to do. Like, we're just going to fill it out with a bunch of junk that you care even less about because, as we all know, Walton Goggins is expensive and Ella Purnell is expensive. So we're going to space them out and we'll put them in, like, 30% of the show, maybe. And, like, dude, I'm getting too old for this stuff. You know what I mean? Like, the Wanderer is the most interesting plot line. That is, in fact, the plot line of the video games. You are the Wanderer. That's what makes it interesting. So wandering through the wasteland with our two heroes is kind of the money. More of that. That's probably what people want. And maybe in the last half of the season, they'll get back to it. What do you think?
Yeah, it's like I said, it's a little bit of a struggle. There's just too many disparate things. I do think there's more Maximus in the Brotherhood of Steel, and kind of this is where it kind of has some fun with a lot of the other factions. You meet the New California Republic, the Legion. The thing is, you meet these other factions very briefly. It's like one episode and then they're kind of gone. Macaulay Culkin was a big thing that, oh, he's gonna be in the show. He's in one episode and he's barely in it. He's one of the Legion characters, and yeah, he. I think he has like five lines of dialogue. I'm like, that could have been anyone. Like, it's not even stunt casting because right. He doesn't act. He just like reads his line. I was like, I could have gone up there and done that. Camille Nanjiani shows up as a member of the Brotherhood of Steel. That he's a fun cameo, and he's in a couple of episodes, so we get a little bit more of him. But yeah, it's just kind of too much. Needs way more focus. By comparison, something like Pluribus is hyper-focused. Like, Rhea Seehorn carries the whole show. She's in virtually every scene. And that's one extreme, but this could use just so much more focus than it has.
Yeah. Well, that's a bummer. I'm sorry to hear it. I guess I need to check it out, but I gotta know, mid-season check-in, would you recommend Fallout Season 2?
I'm still gonna stick with it. It is... like the end of the most recent episode was pretty solid. I think for fans of the show, if you like the first show, stick with it, but just know it's going to be a little slow. It's going to be a little disparate. It might all pull it together by the end of the season, but it's been a bit of a chore.
Respect. One more to talk about. HBO's Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, right? This Game of Thrones follow-up that I know very little about. You've been watching.
Yeah, so this just premiered on Sunday night, A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, which is a new spin-off, a Game of Thrones spin-off show, very different from what we've come to know from Game of Thrones. It features Peter Claffey as Sir Duncan the Tall, who is Sir Duncan. These are based on a series of short novellas by George R. R. Martin called Duncan Egg. He is Sir Duncan the Tall. His squire is a small bald boy named Egg. And this is a very different kind of show. It's been pitched as a little bit lighter, more like a sitcom even. It's a shorter show. There's 30 to 40 minute episodes. I think the pilot's only 40 minutes. So it's not meant to be a big sprawling Game of Thrones-esque thing. And Sir Duncan is, when we first meet him, he has just buried his master, the person who taught him sword and shield, and he's contemplating what to do next. Do I go to King's Landing? Do I rob and steal? And he gets the idea. He's like, there's a knight's tournament down the road at Ashford, and it's not a huge tournament. Maybe I can get in. He has a few horses. He's got a sword and shield, but he has no nobility. And so our first episode, he's on a quest to kind of get someone to vouch for him. We meet some other players. We meet one of the Baratheons. The other thing is the timeline. This takes place 100 years before Game of Thrones and 100 years after House of the Dragon. And so there are no dragons in this timeline. They have
perfectly,
all become
extinct. Perfectly sandwiched. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's a kind of show you can just walk into. You don't have to like have read things. You don't have to know the lore. You can just walk in and have fun. And I liked it. It's fun. It's silly. It's lighthearted, but it's still, it looks expensive. Like, I think it's still like a $10, $15 million kind of show. So it's off to a good start, I think.
Yeah, just flipping through the trailers here on the video stream, it looks exactly like Game of Thrones. Like the costuming, the coloring, like it definitely looks like they shot it in Westeros, which is great. I think this is a smart move for HBO. We just talked about in the open on the news, like Dave Filoni taking over Star Wars and whether or not they need to move forward or backwards or what's kind of next. Game of Thrones, as people understand it, is a political drama that is 1 hour in length that runs every Sunday. House of the Dragon kind of lands in a similar space. This is a good way to start to grow it out in a different way. Say, hey, no, we can be something else. We can adapt these kind of short stories. Yeah, it's shorter, lighter. I don't know, man. It sounds cool. Do you know how many episodes it is? Like, I guess I'm looking for a recommendation, and you'll tell me at the end. But
right, so it's only six episodes, so it's going to be a shorter. Like I said, it's a shorter overall. It's a smaller in scope. You know, one thing I listened to was like, you know, it's not about someone vying for the throne or trying to wheel and deal. It's just it's a much smaller.
Right.
Sir Duncan is what's called a hedge knight, meaning he sleeps under the hedge. He's not nobility, but he's also like he has skills as a knight, which can be of use in this place. I know that there are three novellas that George R. R. Martin has written, so they I think they have three seasons of this planned, and they're potentially more. So we'll see.
How many episodes have you seen so far?
Just one. They just released the pilot on Sunday.
I'm curious, in that first episode, a telltale sign of a Game of Thrones project is like anybody can go at any moment, right? It's like dangerous. Is that sense of danger in this show as well? And is it also in House of the Dragon? Because I'm not even caught up on that.
It is in House of the Dragon. It is not in this show. Like I said, it's just kind of a different thing. Like we don't have warring people. It's not about battles and things like that. It's just kind of the everyman. That was another thing is most people in Game of Thrones, they're all kind of cutthroats and deceivers. And, you know, a lot of times it's the bad people women winning. And Sir Duncan he's kind of a good guy trying to do the right things. He's trying to like make a living. So it's, like I said, it's very different.
All right. Well, I got to know, would you recommend Knight of the Seven Kingdoms?
Yeah, it's a great first start. If you're a fan of Game of Thrones, even if you've maybe not seen the latest stuff, like if you haven't watched House of the Dragon, this is still a great place to jump into. And it's only 40 minutes. It's funny. It's lighthearted. It still looks good. We have all the polish of an HBO show. So I would recommend it to both fans and casual fans of Game of Thrones.
All right, I got to saddle up and watch first episode. It's like a half hour. That's easy. I can get through that, right? Like, that's for me. So, yeah, I'll check out Knight of Seven Kingdoms. Man, that's TV Corner. I said at the top of the episode that this is one of our best double features, potentially, of 2026, even though this film actually is a 2025 release. Very excited to talk about it. And he's taking the summary, which is a challenge. I feel like I had it easy with Bone Temple. Like, he's got an uphill battle, so let's give him some room. Andy, please, take it away.
No other choice. So this is the long-awaited follow-up from director Park Chan-wook, who previously did Decision to Leave and, of course, is known for things like The Handmaiden and Old Boy from 2003, where he kind of first burst on to the scene. This movie's great. This really cracked me up. It's about Man-soo, played by Lee Byung-hun, who is someone who's worked a long time at a paper mill or like a paper factory. And he is very quickly laid off from a job he's been at for 25 years. And he is struggling to then get rehired. And his job is kind of a huge part of his identity. He's the patriarch of this family. He's a provider. He's bought this childhood home that he grew up in and now owns. His daughter plays cello. His wife doesn't work. She just spends her days playing tennis. He gardens, and so he's cultivated this life of upper middle classdom, and it's now being threatened by the struggles of employment. And this movie kind of hit close to home if you've ever applied for jobs and done interviews and been frustrated by that whole process. Because our main character gets to do a lot of those things in a lot of funny fashion. He eventually realizes or comes up with a plan to eliminate his competition. There's a big job coming up. He knows he's the guy, but he knows there might be some competition as well. So he finds out who else is applying for it, decides to take them out in comedic fashion. And it kind of goes over. He's a terrible criminal, but he kind of is still going through these plans. But very interesting film, a sister film to something like Parasite. You know, we have a family of four. We have this, the house is a big kind of character. A lot of similarities, but still dealing with very different things. Zach, what'd you think?
So I think this movie's really fantastic. I was lucky enough to rewatch Decision to Leave just a few weeks ago. Somebody got it for me for Christmas. My brother-in-law is very cool of him. And we had seen that movie in a theater and I liked it okay. And I remember people saying later, like, God, Decision to Leave was incredible, right? It's one of my favorite films of the year. So revisiting it, I was like, yeah, okay, let me see if I can get back into it. And like that second watch, I was like, oh boy, there's a lot of craft in here that I forgot about and a lot of like incredible framing, brilliant transitions. The way Park Chan-wook shoots technology is incredible. All of this to say that like I was very much looking forward to walking into this movie and seeing it in a theater and was not at all disappointed. This movie is tremendous, tremendous. And it's probably maybe Park Chan-wook's funniest film. It is dark. It is twisted. It is based on a book, Donald Westlake's 1997 novel, The Axe. And interestingly, this is a direct adaptation of that film. This is not a remake of Greek director Costa Gavras' film, The Axe, which came out in 2005. Costa Gavras had the rights to this, and when Park Chan-wook read the book, he loved it, started developing the project, and somebody was like, hey, you got to talk to that director. He owns the screen rights to this. And so he goes and talks to him, totally goes over great. Gavras helps him adapt this. Gavras gets a special thanks credit at the end of the movie, and we have this. And yeah, it's a bit like Sweeney Todd, right? Like you have your protagonist who's just icing other people to get by. The A24 movie, How to Make a Killing, starring Glenn Powell and Margaret Qualley this year, also kind of has a similar shape, right? Yeah, you have your protagonist who for some dark and twisted reason has to start murdering people one by one to get ahead, right? That's the pitch. But I love this sort of fable that they're telling here about Mansu and his family. Mansu, who is a gardener and works in a paper company. Paper, which is a very old technology, being bought out and replaced by foreign influence and replacing employees with machines and classic technologies being replaced by AI. Like all of that is relevant here in this story. And I just find it so fascinating. It's dark, it's twisted, it's edited beautifully. I'm excited to talk about it. What do you think of No Other Choice?
Man, really loved it. It's a little long in the middle, like it's 2.5 hours, but the beginning really cooks. Like I said, when he gets fired pretty quickly and, you know, he has a few months of savings, he gets a part-time job, excuse me. And, but it, again, it's his savings starts to dwindle. And again, this more than anything, it affects his psyche because, you know, his children have to stop their activities. His wife takes on a second job or a part-time job and as a dental hygienist, which isn't like, it's not like she just applied at like Starbucks. Like that's a trained position. So, his position and pride's a big theme as well, starts to take a hit. There's this fascinating, there's a lot of plants in the film and there's this whole like plant motif that I'm not going to get into here because it's more fun if you discover it for yourself. But it's just so brilliant thematically. It's diabolically funny because our protagonist is such an idiot. Like he is not a criminal. He's not a killer. He's just bumbling through these murders and may sort of get away with it. Maybe not for long. But it's so funny along the way. And like I said, it's so relatable if you've, like him applying for stuff and going to these interviews, it's brutal. It's grueling because, you know, there's someone's writes a cover letter that's like, oh, my love for paper started, but before I was born, my uncle first ran paper for the, you know, it's just like, oh my gosh, it's such BS. And, but we've all had to do that. Anyone's who's had to apply for places, this is a game you have to play. It's terrible. And that's largely what the film is about. It's about these terrible systems that we've created for ourselves.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier, like, it almost feels like a sister film to something like Bong Joon-ho's Parasite, and, like, couldn't agree more, especially because it's coming out of the same country. Man, this is South Korea's selection for the Oscars in 2026, in 98th Academy Awards, coming up in 2026 in March. You told me just earlier this week that part of the reason it feels like they're running this in January is so they can generate some additional Oscar buzz, like, and hopefully like get some more noms, like get placed more. That's why Neon put this here in the schedule. But Lee Byung-hun as Mansu, I think this is maybe an Oscar performance. He's amazing. I cannot believe how great he is in this movie. His performance is so stunningly physical. Like, not only does he manage to carry this absurd premise of, like, we're supposed to be laughing at a guy who's murdering people for work that he may not even get, like, just so he can hope that he can be a good applicant. And it absolutely works. He is this father who's absolutely tortured and racked with guilt, seeing his family literally suffer, like, one after another, one loss after another, because he cannot find work. And, like, the movie so brilliantly opens with this wonderful, like, summer scene where they're, like, out grilling eel and his daughter's playing music, really clever use of diegetic sound in there, good Park Chan-wook stuff. And his son is, like, doing his thing, and the daughter's, and the wife's like, everything's great. Come in for a group hug, guys. Bring the dogs over. Like, life is so good, and it's such a great setup for, like, so you lost your job, and now you have nothing, and everything sucks, and it just keeps getting worse. And it's such great setup for these kind of victims that he ends up running into who are all just shades of him in a different life. I've seen people speculate that they represent his past, present, and future. The first one who he kind of bumbles through is, like, a guy who's been unemployed for, like, months, years even, like, has just totally given up and is depressed. The second one is a guy who's getting back on his feet. And the third is a guy who's really got his life together and has a job that he loves. You know what I mean? And they kind of all represent different versions of paper employees, just like him. Guys who are like, I've been doing this for years, just like you said. Other people said it has something to do with, like, speak no evil, see no evil, hear no evil is relevant to these guys, like, which is weird. Like, or I got this backwards. Like, there's these, like, overriding themes of nature and masculinity and struggle and capitalism that all weave into this, like, plant roots, which I think is apt for what's happening here. I should pass it back to you. I talk too much. I feel like
one of my favorite aspects is this issue of pride, because a lot of these characters, their wives are telling them, go get a part-time job, go, like, work in a different sector, go, and they just cannot move on. Because it probably means a bit of a downgrade in lifestyle, but they're like, you know, paper has fed this family for 25 years, and it'll feed it for 25 more, god damn it. You know, like, they're so prideful to have to change or admit that they need to change how they live and make adjustments in their life. And they refuse. Oh, one of the things is, like, they're told to, you know, just sell the house, and then, you know, you'll have a huge amount of money to, like, fall back on, rent an apartment, like, just, like, but no one wants to move backwards, and that's understandable. It's very difficult. And at the beginning of the movie, he's been, you know, he's a middle manager who's close to kind of getting to upper management, and, you know, he's enjoying some eel that was sent to them by corporate. So he's right there. He can taste it, but the pride makes him unable to do other things that would help the situation, or that might require a downgrade in his lifestyle a little bit. It's fascinating stuff.
Yeah, Mansu is set in his ways. He lives in the house he grew up in, right? That's mentioned early. We love a house movie. The house that opens in, that this family lives in, is tremendous. Multi-layered, multi-leveled, shot beautifully. And we have this big greenhouse on the side where he does a lot of his gardening. That's kind of his hobby. That's something he's very talented in. And he uses some of those skills maybe to dispatch some of his folks as well. As things start to close in, like, as in traditional films where people are murdering one another, as suddenly somebody finds a clue somewhere, or a loved one hears a little something in the other room, or maybe even cops show up and say, hey, sir, have you heard anything about this? As the noose starts to tighten around Mansu, things start to get threatening. But I think what's so cool about this movie is not necessarily, like, the ending, or how, like, where our characters specifically end up, but kind of this larger fable that is being told here about this man who is, like, one of so many people. Like Andy said, we can all see reflections of this very struggle in our own lives. Everybody has had to do this. Everybody's had to, like, go to interview after interview and try to figure it out and just feel less than worthless as your savings continue to dwindle. Like, it all creates such a juicy soil to, like, grow something special in. I love the way technology is shot in this movie. There are incredible transitions in this movie. Park Chan-wook is working with his longtime editor on this. What is his name? Kim Sang-bom. And they shot the movie in 5 months, from August 2024 to just January 2025. And now here it is. A year later, we have our movie. Really, really tremendous work. Like, just outstanding. I'm running out of things to say. Anything else, Andy?
I wanted to talk a little bit. The movie has a lot to say about masculinity, and like I said, the pressure that we put on ourselves from these systems. Again, he's the head of the household. He's the patriarch. He's curated this very specific kind of life, and it all starts to fall apart when he doesn't have his job. And there's the women in the film play interesting roles, because they're trying to be the supportive spouses, but then, you know, when they have to start working, and then other men start trying to swoop in. That happens to a number of characters, people getting cucked all throughout the film. So it's just, like I said, there, it's very deep. And like I said, it's a sister film to Parasite, but it's dealing with very different things. It's looking at very different aspects of our capitalist hellscape.
Yeah, and thoughtful and funny right down to the title, right? Like, a couple of characters in the film say key points, "I have no other choice." And every time they absolutely do. Like, that's not even a real phrase. "Oh, there's nothing I can do." There's always a choice. And it's so funny that this movie just drives directly down this direction. Because in a lot of ways, it feels like where we're headed, right? Like, it feels like everybody's being replaced by machines. Your job's going to be automated. AI's going to take over. Some American company's going to monopolize the industry. And this is the way it's going to be. And it's uncomfortable. And it's frightening. And the process of finding a new work is scary and uncertain. And, like, it preys on all of these things and plays on them in a way that just pushes our characters around in the most bold of directions. Really tremendous work. Any other thoughts or recommendations?
I'm ready.
Andy, would you recommend No Other Choice?
Yeah, absolutely would. One of the best films of the year. It would have been made my top 10, maybe top five even. Again, it's thematically very rich. It's really funny, really strong performances from our leads, Lee Byung-hun and Son Ye-jin. Lots to do. It's a very mature film. Don't take the family. Don't take the kids. It's a little long in the tooth at a full, like, 2.5 hours. I feel like it could have tightened up a little bit in the center, but highly recommend.
Yeah, fantastic work from Park Chan-wook. Delightful. Would recommend. Go see it in a theater if possible. Big screen plays great. There's a little bit of funny blue screen early in the movie. Don't let it stop you. The movie, it's barely in the rest of it. It freaked me out a little at first, but great themes, hilarious premise, brilliant performances. This movie should get 7 Oscar noms. I think it is so cool. No Other Choice rocks. Please go see it whenever you can. And that is episode 322 of Offscript Film Review, a double theatrical this week. And what a double feature it was. Good Lord, these are both cool movies. Like, love a double recommend. What are we watching next week, Andy?
So we're going to be checking out The Rip, which is on Netflix. Came out last week, actually. It's a cop action drama starring Matt Damon and Ben Affleck that we've heard some things about, some good things, but it's also a straight to Netflix film in January. Then we're going to kind of do some TBD, see what else is out there, probably do another rental. There's not a lot of new things out, but some other FYI releases. The Testament of Anne Lee, which comes out January 23rd, which is the Amanda Seyfried vehicle about the founding of the Shaker movement that we've heard a lot about. Also, Return to Silent Hill, the horror series, returns this Friday, also January 23rd. But The Rip and TBD next week.
If you enjoyed the episode today, if you like what we're doing here on Offscript Film Review, the best way you can support us is just subscribe to the channel. Subscribe on audio platforms if you're listening on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartMedia. Subscribe on YouTube, where we're uploading new content every single week. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok. Follow us on all the usual social media places. Like and comment where you can, man. Like, it all helps. Every click helps in the almighty algorithm. And we appreciate you guys spending some time with us. From all of us at Offscript, the home, Bold Cinema, I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Thanks for watching.